John. Day and night the axes rang. John could not remember the last time he had slept. When he closed his eyes, he dreamed of fighting. When he woke, he fought. Even in the King's Tower, he could hear the ceaseless thunk of bronze and flint and stolen steel biting into wood, and it was louder when he tried to rest in the warming shed atop the wall. Mans had sledgehammers at work as well, and long saws with teeth of bone and flint. Once, as he was drifting off into an exhausted sleep, there came a great cracking from the haunted forest, and a sentinel tree came crashing down in a cloud of dirt and needles. He was awake when Owen came to him, lying restless under a pile of furs on the floor of the warming shed.
"Lord Snow," said Owen, shaking his shoulder, "the dawn."
He gave John a hand to help pull him back onto his feet. Others were waking as well, jostling one another as they pulled on their boots and buckled their sword belts in the close confines of the shed. No one spoke. They were all too tired to talk. Few of them ever left the wall these days. It took too long to ride up and down in the cage. Castle Black had been abandoned to Maester Aemon, Sir Winton Stout, and a few others too old or ill to fight.
"I had a dream that the king had come," Owen said happily. "Maester Aemon sent a raven, and King Robert came with all his strength. I dreamed I saw his golden banners."
John made himself smile. "That would be a welcome sight to see, Owen." Ignoring the twinge of pain in his leg, he swept a black fur cloak about his shoulders, gathered up his crutch, and went out onto the wall to face another day. A gust of wind sent icy tendrils wending through his long brown hair. Half a mile north, the wildling encampments were stirring, their campfires sending up smoky fingers to scratch against the pale dawn sky. Along the edge of the forest, they had raised their tents of hide and fur, even a crude long haul of logs and woven branches. There were horse lines to the east, mammoths to the west, and men everywhere, sharpening their swords, putting points on crude spears, donning makeshift armor of hide and horn and bone. For every man that he could see, John knew there were a score unseen in the wood. The brush gave them some shelter from the elements and hid them from the eyes of the hated crows. Already their archers were stealing forward, pushing their rolling mantlets.
"Here come our breakfast arrows,"
Pip announced cheerfully, as he did every morning. "It's good he can make a jape of it," John thought. "Someone has to." 3 days ago, one of those breakfast arrows had caught Red Allen of the Rosewood in the leg. You could still see his body at the foot of the wall, if you cared to lean out far enough. John had to think that it was better for them to smile at Pip's jest than to brood over Allen's corpse. The mantlets were slanting wooden shields, wide enough for five of the free folk to hide behind. The archers pushed them close, then knelt behind them to loose their arrows through slits in the wood. The first time the wildlings rolled them out, John had called for fire arrows and set a half dozen ablaze, but after that men started covering them with raw hides. All the fire arrows in the world couldn't make them catch now. The brothers even started wagering as to which of the straw sentinels would collect the most arrows before they were done. Dolorous Ed was leading with four, but Othol Yarwick, Tumbajohn, and Wat of Longlake had three apiece. It was Pip who started naming the scarecrows after their missing brothers, too.
"It makes it seem as if there's more of us," he said. "More of us with arrows in our bellies," Gren complained.
But the custom did seem to give his brother's heart, so John let the name stand and the wagering continue. On the edge of the wall, an ornate brass Moorish eye stood on three spindly legs. Maester Aemon had once used it to peer at the stars, before his own eyes had failed him. John swung the tube down to have a look at the foe. Even at this distance, there was no mistaking Manse Raider's huge white tent, sewn together from the pelts of snow bears. The Moorish lenses brought the wildlings close enough for him to make out faces. Of Mance himself he saw no sign this morning, but his woman, Darla, was outside tending the fire, while her sister Val milked a she-goat beside the tent. Darla looked so big, it was a wonder she could move. A child must be coming very soon, John thought. He swiveled the eye east and searched amongst the tents and trees till he found the turtle. That will be coming very soon as well. The wildlings had skinned one of the dead mammoths during the night, and they were lashing the raw, bloody hide over the turtle's roof, one more layer on top of the sheepskins and pelts. The turtle had a rounded top and eight huge wheels, and under the hides was a stout wooden frame. When the wildlings had begun knocking it together, Saturn thought they were building a ship. Not far wrong. The turtle was a hull turned upside down and opened fore and aft, a long haul on wheels.
"It's done, isn't it?" asked Wren.
"Near enough." John shoved away the eye. "It will come today, most like. Did you fill the barrels?"
"Every one. They froze hard during the night. Pip checked."
Wren had changed a great deal from the big, clumsy, redneck boy John had first befriended. He had grown half a foot. His chest and shoulders had thickened, and he had not cut his hair nor trimmed his beard since the fist of the first men. It made him look as huge and shaggy as an oryx, the mocking name that Sir Alistair Thorne had hung on him during training. He looked weary now, though. When John said as much, he nodded.
"I heard their axes all night. Couldn't sleep for all the chopping."
"Then go sleep now."
"I don't need. You do. I want you rested. Go on.
I'm not going to let you sleep through the fight." He made himself smile. "You're the only one who can move those bloody barrels." Wren went off muttering, and John returned to the far eye, searching the wildling camp. From time to time an arrow would sail past overhead, but he learned to ignore those. The range was long, and the angle was bad. The chances of being hit were small. He still saw no sign of Man's raider in the camp, but he spied Tormund Giantsbane and two of his sons around the turtle. The sons were struggling with the mammoth hide, while Tormund gnawed on the roast leg of a goat and bellowed orders. Elsewhere he found the wildling skin-changer, Varamyr Sixskins, walking through the trees with his shadow cat dogging his heels. When he heard the rattle of the winch-chains and the iron groan of the cage door opening, he knew it would be Hub bringing their breakfast as he did every morning. The sight of Mance's turtle had robbed John of his appetite. Their oil was all but gone, and the last barrel of pitch had been rolled off the wall two nights ago. They would soon run short of arrows as well, and there were no Fletchers making more. And the night before last, a raven had come from the west, from Sir Dennis Mallister. Bowen Marsh had chased the wildlings all the way to the Shadow Tower, it seemed, and then farther, down into the gloom of the gorge. At the Bridge of Skulls he had met the Weeper and 300 wildlings and won a bloody battle. But the victory had been a costly one. More than 100 brothers slain, among them Sir Andrew Tarth and Sir Allardale Winch. The old pomegranate himself had been carried back to the Shadow Tower, sorely wounded. Maester Mullen was tending him, but it would be some time before he was fit to return to Castle Black. When he had read that, John had dispatched Zay to Molestown on their best horse to plead with the villagers to help man the wall. She never returned. When he sent Molly after her, he came back to report the whole village deserted, even the brothel. Most likely Zay had followed them, straight down the King's Road. "Maybe we should all do the same," John reflected glumly. He made himself eat, hungry or no. Bad enough, he could not sleep. He could not go on without food as well. Besides, this might be my last meal. It might be the last meal for all of us. So it was that John had a belly full of bread, bacon, onions and cheese when he heard Horse shout, "It's coming!" No one needed to ask what it was, nor did John need the maester's Moorish eye to see it creeping out from amongst the tents and trees. "It doesn't really look much like a turtle," Saturn commented. "Turtles don't have fur." Most of them don't have wheels either, said Pip. Sound the war horn, John commanded, and Keggs blew two long blasts to wake Gren and the other sleepers who'd had the watch during the night. If the wildlings were coming, the wall would need every man. Gods know we have few enough. John looked at Pip and Keggs and Satin, Horse and Owen the Oaf, Tim Tangletongue, Molly Spareboot and the rest, and tried to imagine them going belly to belly and blade to blade against 100 screaming wildlings in the freezing darkness of that tunnel, with only a few iron bars between them. That was what it would come down to, unless they could stop the turtle before the gate was breached.
It's big, Horse said.
Pip smacked his lips. Think of all the soup it will make. The jape was stillborn. Even Pip sounded tired. He looks half dead, John thought. But so do we all. The king beyond the wall had so many men that he could throw fresh attackers at them every time. But the same handful of black brothers had to meet every assault, and it had worn them ragged. The men beneath the wooden hides would be pulling hard, John knew, putting their shoulders into it, straining to keep the wheels turning. But once the turtle was flush against the gate, they would exchange their ropes for axes. At least Mance was not sending his mammoths today. John was glad of that. Their awesome strength was wasted on the wall, and their size only made them easy targets. The last had been a day and a half in the dying. Its mournful trumpeting is terrible to hear. The turtle crept slowly through stones and stumps and brush. The earlier attacks had cost the free folk 100 lives or more. Most still lay where they had fallen. In the lulls, the crows would come and pay them court. But now the birds fled, screeching. They liked the look of that turtle no more than he did. Satin, Horse, and the others were looking to him, John knew, waiting for his orders. He was so tired, he hardly knew any more. The wall is mine, he reminded himself. Owen, Horse, to the catapults. Keggs, you and Spareboot on the scorpions. The rest of you string your bows. Fire arrows. Let's see if we can burn it. It was likely to be a futile gesture, John knew, but it had to be better than standing helpless. Cumbersome and slow-moving, the turtle made for an easy shot, and his archers and crossbowmen soon turned it into a lumbering wooden hedgehog. But the wet hides protected it, just as they had the mantlets, and the flaming arrows gutted out almost as soon as they struck. John cursed under his breath. Scorpions, he commanded. Catapults! The scorpions' bolts punched deep into the pelts, but did no more damage than the fire arrows. The rocks went bouncing off the turtle's roof, leaving dimples in the thick layers of hides. A stone from one of the trebuchets might have crushed it, but the one machine was still broken, and the wildlings had gone wide around the area where the other dropped its loads. "John is still coming," said Owen the Oaf. He could see that for himself. Inch by inch, yard by yard, the turtle crept closer, rolling, rumbling, and rocking as it crossed the killing ground. Once the wildlings got it flush against the wall, it would give them all the shelter they needed whilst their axes crashed through the hastily repaired outer gates. Inside, under the ice, they would clear the loose rubble from the tunnel in a matter of hours, and then there would be nothing to stop them but two iron gates, a few half-frozen corpses, and whatever brothers John cared to throw in their path to fight and die down in the dark. To his left, the catapult made a thunk and filled the air with spinning stones. They plunked down on the turtle like hail and caromed harmlessly aside. The wilding archers were still loosing arrows from behind their mantlets. One thudded into the face of a straw man, and Pip said, "Four for Wat of Longlake. We have a tie." The next shaft whistled past his own ear, however. "Fie," he shouted down. "I'm not in the tourney." "The hides won't burn," John said, as much to himself as to the others. Their only hope was to try and crush the turtle when it reached the wall. For that they needed boulders. No matter how stoutly built the turtle was, a huge chunk of rock crashing straight down on top of it from 700 feet was bound to do some damage. Gren, Owen, Keggs, it's time. Alongside the warming shed, a dozen stout oaken barrels were lined up in a row. They were full of crushed rock, the gravel that the Black Brothers customarily spread on the footpaths to give themselves better footing atop the wall. Yesterday, after he'd seen the free folk covering the turtle with sheepskins, John told Gren to pour water into the barrels, as much as they would take. The water would seep down through the crushed stone, and overnight the whole thing would freeze solid. It was the nearest thing to a boulder they were going to get.
"Why do we need to freeze it?" Gren had asked him. "Why don't we just roll the barrels off the way they are?"
John answered, "If they crash against the wall on the way down, they'll burst, and loose gravel will spray everywhere. We don't want to rain pebbles on the horses." He put his shoulder to the one barrel with Gren, while Keggs and Owen were wrestling with another. Together, they rocked it back and forth to break the grip of the ice that had formed around its bottom.
"The bugger weighs a ton," said Gren.
"Tip it over and roll it," John said. "Careful. If it rolls over your foot, you'll end up like Spare Boot." Once the barrel was on its side, John grabbed a torch and waved it above the surface of the wall, back and forth, just enough to melt the ice a little. The thin film of water helped the barrel roll more easily. Too easily, in fact. They almost lost it. But finally, with four of them pooling their efforts, they rolled their boulder to the edge and stood it up again. They had four of the big oak barrels lined up above the gate by the time Pip shouted, "There's a turtle at our door!" John braced his injured leg and leaned out for a look. Hoardings. Marsh should have built hoardings. So many things they should have done. The wildlings were dragging the dead giants away from the gate. Horse and Mully were dropping rocks down on them, and John thought he saw one man go down. But the stones were too small to have any effect on the turtle itself. He wondered what the free folk would do about the dead mammoth in the path. But then he saw. The turtle was almost as wide as a longhorn. So they simply pushed it over the carcass. His leg twitched, but Horse caught his arm and drew him back to safety.
"You shouldn't lean out like that," the boy said.
"We should have built hoardings." John thought he could hear the crash of axes on wood, but that was probably just fear ringing in his ears. He looked to Gren.
"Do it!"
Gren got behind a barrel, put his shoulder against it, grunted, and began to push. Owen and Mully moved to help him. They shoved the barrel out a foot, and then another, and suddenly it was gone. They heard the thump as it struck the wall on the way down, and then, much louder, the crash and crack of splintering wood, followed by shouts and screams. Satin whooped, and Owen the Oaf danced in circles while Pip leaned out and called,
"The turtle was stuffed full of rabbits! Look at them hop away!"
"Again!" John barked, and Gren and Keggs slammed their shoulders against the next barrel and sent it tottering out into empty air. By the time they were done, the front of Mance's turtle was a crushed and splintered ruin, and wildlings were spilling out the other end and scrambling for their camp. Satin scooped up his crossbow and set a few quarrels after them as they ran, to see them off the faster. Gren was grinning through his beard, Pip was making japes, and none of them would die today. On the morrow, though, John glanced toward the shed. Eight barrels of gravel remained, where 12 had stood a few moments before. He realized how tired he was then, and how much his wound was hurting. "I need to sleep, a few hours at least." He could go to Maester Aemon for some dream wine, that would help. "I'm going down to the King's Tower," he told them. "Call me if Mance gets up to anything. Pip, you have the wall."
"Me?" said Pip.
"Him?" said Gren.
Smiling, he left them to it and rode down in the cage. A cup of dream wine did help, as it happened. No sooner had he stretched out on the narrow bed in his cell than sleep took him. His dreams were strange and formless, full of strange voices, shouts and cries, and the sound of a war horn blowing low and loud. A single deep booming note that lingered in the air. When he awoke, the sky was black outside the arrow slit that served him for a window, and four men he did not know were standing over him. One held a lantern.
"John Snow," the tallest of them said brusquely, "pull in your boots and come with us."
His first groggy thought was that somehow the wall had fallen whilst he'd slept, that man's raider had sent more giants or another turtle and broken through the gate. But when he rubbed his eyes, he saw that the strangers were all in black. "They're men of the Night's Watch," John realized.
"Come where? Who are you?"
The tall man gestured, and two of the others pulled John from the bed. With the lantern leading the way, they marched him from his cell and up a half turn of stair to the old bear's solar. He saw Maester Aemon standing by the fire, his hands folded around the head of a blackthorn cane. Septon Celador was half drunk as usual, and Sir Winton Stout was asleep in a window seat. The other brothers were strangers to him, all but one. Immaculate in his fur-trimmed cloak and polished boots, Sir Alistair Thorne turned to say,
"Here's a turncloak now, my lord. Ned Stark's bastard, of Winterfell."
"I'm no turncloak, Thorne," John said coldly.
"We shall see."
In the leather chair behind the table where the old bear wrote his letters sat a big, broad, jowly man John did not know.
"Yes, we shall see," he said again. "You will not deny that you are John Snow, I hope. Stark's bastard. Lord Snow, he likes to call himself."
Sir Alistair was a spare, slim man, compact and sinewy, and just now his flinty eyes were dark with amusement. "You're the one who named me Lord Snow," said John. Sir Alistair had been fond of naming the boys he trained during his time as Castle Black's master-at-arms. The old bear had sent Thorne to Eastwatch by the sea. These others must be Eastwatch men. The bird reached Cutter Pike, and he sent us help. "How many men have you brought?" he asked the man behind the table.
"It's me who'll ask the questions,"
the jolly man replied.
"You've been charged with oath-breaking, cowardice, and desertion, John Snow. Do you deny that you abandoned your brothers to die on the fist of the first men, and joined the wildling Mance Rayder, this self-styled king beyond the wall?"
"Abandon?" John almost choked on the word. Maester Aemon spoke up then.
"My lord, Donald Noy and I discussed these issues when John Snow first returned to us and were satisfied by John's explanations."
"Well, I am not satisfied, Maester," said the jolly man. "I will hear these explanations for myself. Yes, I will."
John swallowed his anger.
"I abandoned no one. I left the fist with Corran Halfhand to scout the Skirling Pass. I joined the wildlings under orders. The Halfhand feared that Mance might have found the Horn of Winter."
"The Horn of Winter?" Sir Alistair chuckled. "Were you commanded to count their snarks as well, Lord Snow?"
"No, but I counted their giants as best I could."
"Sir," snapped the jolly man, "you will address Sir Alistair as Sir, and myself as my lord. I am Janus Slint, Lord of Harrenhal, and commander here at Castle Black, until such time as Bourne Marsh returns with his garrison. You will grant us our courtesies, yes? I will not suffer to hear an anointed knight like the good Sir Alistair mocked by a traitor's bastard."
He raised a hand and pointed a meaty finger at John's face. "Do you deny that you took a wildling woman into your bed?"
"No." John's grief over Ygritte was too fresh for him to deny her now. "No, my lord."
"I suppose it was also the Halfhand who commanded you to fuck this unwashed whore,"
Sir Alistair asked with a smirk.
"Sir, she was no whore, sir. The Halfhand told me not to balk whatever the wildlings asked of me, but I will not deny that I went beyond what I had to do, that I cared for her."
"You admit to being an oath-breaker, then,"
said Jaina Slint. Half the men at Castle Black visited Molestown from time to time to dig for buried treasure in the brothel, John knew. But he would not dishonour Ygritte by equating her with the Molestown whores. I broke my vows with a woman. I admit that, yes.
Yes, my lord.
When Slint scowled, his jowls quivered. He was as broad as the old bear had been, and no doubt would be as bald if he lived to Mormont's age. Half his hair was gone already, though he could not have been more than 40. Yes, my lord, John said. I rode with the wildlings and ate with them, as the half-hand commanded me, and I shared my furs with Ygritte. But I swear to you, I never turned my cloak. I escaped the Magnar as soon as I could, and never took up arms against my brothers or the realm. Lord Slint's small eyes studied him.
Sir Glendon, he commanded, bring in the other prisoner.
Sir Glendon was the tall man who had dragged John from his bed. Four other men went with him when he left the room. But they were back soon enough with a captive, a small, sallow, battered man, fettered hand and foot. He had a single eyebrow, a widow's peak, and a moustache that looked like a smear of dirt on his upper lip. But his face was swollen and mottled with bruises, and most of his front teeth had been knocked out. The East Watchmen threw the captive roughly to the floor. Lord Slint frowned down on him.
Is this the one you spoke of?
The captive blinked yellow eyes.
Aye.
Not until that instant did John recognize Rattleshirt. He is a different man without his armor, he thought.
Aye, the wildling repeated. He's the craven, kill the half-hand, up in a frost fangs it were, after we'd hunted down t'other crows, and killed them, everyone. We would have done for this one too, only he begged for his worthless life, offered to join us if we'd have him. The half-hand swore he'd see the craven dead first, but the wolf ripped Corrin half to pieces, and this one opened his throat.
He gave John a crack-tooth smile then, and spat blood on his foot.
Well, Jaina Slint demanded of John harshly, do you deny it, or will you claim Corrin commanded you to kill him?
He told me, the words came hard, he told me to do whatever they asked of me. Slint looked about the solar at the other East Watchmen.
Does this boy think I fell off a turnip wagon onto my head?
Your lies won't save you now, Lord Snow, warned Sir Alistair Thorne. We'll have the truth from you, bastard. I've told you the truth. Our garrons were failing and Rattleshirt was close behind us. Corrin told me to pretend to join the wildlings. You must not balk whatever is asked of you, he said. He knew they would make me kill him. Rattleshirt was going to kill him anyway. He knew that too.
So now you claim the great Corrin Halfhand feared this creature?
Slint looked at Rattleshirt and snorted.
All men fear the Lord of Bounds,
the wildling grumbled. Sir Glendon kicked him, and he lapsed back into silence. I never said that, John insisted. Slint slammed a fist on the table.
I heard you. Sir Alistair had your measure true enough, it seems. You lie through your bastard teeth. Well, I will not suffer it. I will not. You might have fooled this crippled blacksmith, but not Jaina Slint. Oh, no, Jaina Slint does not swallow lies so easily. Do you think my skull was stuffed with cabbage?
I don't know what your skull is stuffed with, my lord. Lord Snow is nothing if not arrogant, said Sir Alistair. He murdered Corrin just as his fellow turncloaks did Lord Marmont.
It would not surprise me to learn that it was all part of the same fell plot. Benjen Stark may well have had a hand in all this as well. For all we know, he's sitting in Mance Raider's tent even now. You know these Starks, my lord.
I do, said Jaina Slint. I know them too well.
John peeled off his glove and showed them his burned hand. I burned my hand defending Lord Mormont from a wight, and my uncle was a man of honour. He would never have betrayed his vows.
No more than you, mocked Sir Alistair.
Septon Celador cleared his throat.
Lord Slint," he said, "this boy refused to swear his vows properly in the sept, but went beyond the wall to see his words before a heart tree. His father's gods, he said, but they are a wildling gods as well." "They are the gods of the north, Septon," Maester Aemon was courteous but firm. "My lords, when Donald Noy was slain, it was this young man, John Snow, who took the wall and held it against all the fury of the north. He has proved himself valiant, loyal, and resourceful. Were it not for him, you would have found Mansraider sitting here when you arrived, Lord Slint. You are doing him a great wrong. John Snow was Lord Mormont's own steward and squire. He was chosen for that duty because the Lord Commander saw much promise in him, as do I."
"Promise?" said Slint. "Well, promise may turn false. Corran Halfhand's blood is on his hands. Mormont trusted him, you see. But what of that? I know what it is to be betrayed by men you trusted. Oh, yes. And I know the ways of wolves as well." He pointed at John's face. "Your father died a traitor."
"My father was murdered." John was past caring what they did to him. But he would not suffer any more lies about his father. Slint purpled.
"Murder? You insolent pup. King Robert was not even called when Lord Eddard moved against his son."
He rose to his feet, a shorter man than Mormont, but thick about the chest and arms with a gut to match. A small gold spear tipped with red enamel pinned his cloak at the shoulder.
"Your father died by the sword, but he was highborn, a king's hand. For you, a noose will serve. Sir Alistair, take this turn cloak to an ice cell."
"My lord is wise." Sir Alistair seized John by the arm. John yanked away and grabbed the knight by the throat with such ferocity that he lifted him off the floor. He would have throttled him if the Eastwatch men had not pulled him off. Thorn staggered back, rubbing the marks John's fingers had left on his neck.
"You see for yourselves, brothers, the boy is a wildling.